This morning, this talk will be a little bit different because it will be interwoven with two testimonies. Testimonies how God has intervened in the lives of two people in this church, this family, in relation to sickness and healing. But before and in order to do that and to explain some things, I just want to bring some teaching alongside these two testimonies and to put some context to them. And I want to do that by looking at the life of Paul, the former church persecutor, who became a church planter, following his encounter with Jesus, whom he was persecuting. Of all the people in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul had significant things to say about whether God does and can heal, through things that he personally experienced himself in his own life, but also through what he encountered in his ministry. And I want to say from the outset, it's God's desire for our wholeness and our well-being in every aspect of our lives. We don't have a God who is vindictive or nasty, but a God who is gracious and merciful. But there are facets in relation to God and his dealings with us that sometimes remain within the mysteries of God, and I leave that with him. God has given us natural health. Let's get the basic things out the way. God has given us natural health so that we have a duty to look after our diet, our exercise, and our rest. And you ignore those at your peril, people, in that sense. Secondly, God has blessed us with what I would call natural healing. Within our bodies is the ability that God has placed for us to develop immunities, our bodies, our skin to heal and things like that, so we have natural healing. God has also blessed us with modern science and medical healing. So thank God for every doctor, every nurse in this room, everyone in the medical profession. Thank you for your skills that you have honed and are still being honed to this very day, that make people well through the advances of medical science. And finally, there's something what I call supernatural healing. That's when God just steps into a situation and determines by his will that he will change something in someone's life. So they're the four aspects that we can get well by in that sense. And I just want to say, and I'm going to skirt over an awful lot this morning. I think God has an awful lot to say through the lives of these two people. But over the years, I've also heard some very unhelpful things preached in relation to God and healing. I've heard things that say it comes down to two things. You're unwell because you live in a sinful life, therefore God has blighted you with this. Number two, you obviously don't have enough faith to be healed. Who's your those two ones? The issue is that there is an element of truth in them, but here is a danger. That element of truth might not relate to that particular individual, and therefore that individual becomes defeated, becomes demoralized, feels condemned, feels confused, because they just don't understand why God is allowing this to happen. You look at Job in all of his sufferings. So I'm speaking quickly. And as I said, it's God's desire for us to be whole and blessed and well in him. And so before our two testimonies, I just want to look at one thought of in Paul's life, and that's in Acts 19, verses 11 to 12. I'll just read through them. But this is the life of Paul, the former persecutor, now a great church planter. So from verse 11, God did, I always smile at this, extraordinary miracles. So you can have ordinary miracles, and you can have extraordinary miracles. And I have a special offer, you have super-duper extraordinary miracles on another day. But Luke wrote it, I believe it. God did extraordinary miracles through Paul, so that even handkerchiefs and aprons that had touched him were taken to those who were ill, and their illnesses were cured, and evil spirits left them. This is Paul and his ministry to Ephesus. And it was marked by what his preaching was marked by divine works of power through the anointing of God on Paul's ministry. And this type of healing that we see where just handkerchiefs and an apron touched by Paul are reminiscent of the healings that Jesus performed. You remember the woman who just touched the cloak and she was healed. And then reminiscent of the healings in relation to Peter. It says of Peter that even his shadow touched some people. and they were healed. So these are these extraordinary miracles in the sense that Peter, Paul, and Jesus did nothing in that sense. It was people, it was the virtue going out of them and people being healed. And so these handkerchiefs and aprons were nothing more than Paul had used for manual physical working. The handkerchief, you read the word handkerchief, don't think of something neatly folded and wrapped up in perfect silk and as a holy facet of some kind. The handkerchief, it actually means it was a sweatband that he tied around his head. When he was manually working to stop the sweat running down into his eyes, he tied the handkerchief around his head to stop him, so he could see what he was doing when he was working. The apron is something that he put around him when he was tent making, so that when all the leather and all the gunge and all the muck and everything, it was going on the apron and not on his clothing. But it says of these items that they were probably worn and a bit sweaty and a bit smelly, but the fact that God used them as a demonstration of his power to authenticate that Paul was preaching the power of the risen Lord, and what better way to do it than something of God be seen in the power of these items being used to touch and heal people. They were authenticating. They were proving that God was God. They were stained, but they were miracles of healing that often accompanied the proclamation of preaching. You look at healing in the Bible, and it's not throughout. It comes in phases. Phases. You hear great healings happening under Elijah and Elisha. And then you have great healings, obviously, under Jesus when he was ministering. And then you have the healings under the apostles in the Acts of the early church. So it was a demonstration of the power of God was moving and working and operating in grace through the lives of his servants and into the lives of the people. Healings were not just for healing's sake. Healings were a demonstration of the power of God. He was moving in a certain way, in a certain place. And on that note, I invite my learned friend, wherever she is, Sarah, come and share your testimony. These two people might be a little bit nervous this morning, so let's encourage them. There you are, and thank you.
Hiya. Hi, everyone. I don't know what's harder, to actually talk in front of you all, or the fact that I got to try and fit 11 years into a couple of minutes. Yeah. But back in 2008, it was just before Christmas, and I was out with some friends from church to go and see a concert. And at that time, it was, I remember waiting for the guy to come out to sing, and out of nowhere, this pain just started in my back. It was a build-up from working really hard throughout the few months leading up to it. And just there, my back went and I couldn't stand upright anymore. I'd gone from standing upright to standing at a complete right angle. And I couldn't move. I was paralysed for a few minutes. My sister managed to get me into a taxi and get me home. And basically that whole Christmas, I couldn't even remember. The whole of the Christmas, it was a blur of pain. And then on Boxing Day, we managed to get me to the A&E. They did all these tests on me. They weren't really able to tell me exactly what it was, aside from two of my discs where my lumbar and sacrum meet. They'd both slipped, but they'd slipped outwards rather than inwards, so the bones were pinching my spinal cord, and they were causing me to just stand paralyzed for a few minutes or wherever, whatever position I was in, and the pain was excruciating. The tests that they put me through, just the consistent tests just to try and find out what, if anything, they could do, but there was nothing. All they could basically give me was painkillers. So they sent me on my way with cocodamol, diazepam, amitriptyline, diclofenac, ibuprofen. They just kept on giving me more painkillers, stronger painkillers, full doses. And there's nothing else they could do aside from this pain to try and manage it. And that's basically how I lasted for the last 11 years. I'd been trying to fix it myself, tried to use TENS machines and different types of creams and things. I'd been to the physiotherapist, I don't know how many times. And I'm okay sometimes, and I can take a few less of the tablets, but aside from that, it was really every single day, constantly on these painkillers. My children have only ever known me with a bad back. I was before I had my kids, so they only ever knew me with a mum who was always in pain. And with Donald, I had a really bad pregnancy. I struggled quite a lot. I ended up with that hip dysplasia, the hip issue that some pregnant women get. So not only am I heavily pregnant with a bad back, I'm now on crutches, trying to walk around. And for the first couple of years of his life, I carried him in a sling on my back. Most of the time, if it was really bad, I'd ask him if I could put him in the sling just so that it would help me stand up better. It was just managing life, basically, managing the pain and trying to get through life. But then this Christmas, I went to see my sister in Manchester, and she prayed over me, and she said that God was telling her that this isn't the life for you, and he doesn't want this for you anymore, and he is going to heal you. And I'd been praying for a long time, and I didn't have the faith at that moment either, because it had it for so long. I'd had this back pain for so many years. Why had God not healed me yet? And I started praying again, and even my children too. Every night, my children have always prayed before they go to sleep. They'd say their prayers, and the last sentence they'd say is, "And please make Mummy's back better." Mm. And we were just, I was constantly praying in church and in the services on our weekly group in Christine and Steve Dunford's house. They've prayed for me a few times there as well. And Steve Dunford on, I think it was July 23rd this year, Steve was speaking in the service. And right at the end, I just felt God to, everyone is starting to disappear. And God said, "Ask me again." And I thought, nah. And then I heard it again, "Ask me again." And I just thought, I turned to my husband and said, "I've got to go and speak to Steve. And I just started walking down. Steve was stood here. And I just said, "I want to be healed. I really want to be healed." And the elders and pastors came and prayed for me. And I could feel, I couldn't really feel anything, I'll be honest. I didn't know if it was doing it, what was happening. And then Craig said, "Do you feel anything?" And I said, "No, I don't really feel anything. My back feels warm, but I don't feel anything." And he said, "Sometimes it can be instant, sometimes it can take a while, and sometimes we just got to wait and see." So I started to walk away, and took me about 5 or 6 steps before I realised I didn't feel anything. I couldn't, it was the first time in such a long time that I've not felt pain. I wasn't aware at that moment that I wasn't in pain anymore. And I just went straight back and just shouted to them, "I don't feel anything." And then I can't remember which one it was, but one of them said, "No, it might take a while." I was like, "No, I don't feel anything anymore. I don't feel any more pain." And they would just start praying again and praising God. And my children have gone from praying, "Please make Mummy's back better," to "Thank you for making Mummy's back better." For me, it's wonderful that my children have been able to be there and see everything that I've gone through, the pain that I've gone through, and to see the instant change from that moment, that morning. It was healed. I've gone from taking all those painkillers on a daily basis to never taking a single one again. I've not had any withdrawal from all the tablets I was on. I've been able to start opening up to friends in work and telling them about, but they knew there was a difference, because when I was in work, if I dropped something, I'd make a decision as to whether it was worth it. Did I really need that? That bank card, do I really need that bank card? I would kick it over to the people and some of the staff and ask them if they could pick it up for me if I was in that much pain. And I've gone from doing that to actually sent the video to Christine Dunford, but I did a yoga pose that I've not done in a very long time. And I did an actual live action version for my friends in work, and they couldn't believe that what I was doing in comparison to how my back was literally 4 or 5 days before. So yeah, I've been really blessed, and I can't believe the difference. We moved for house last week, and if that had happened before my back had been healed, I would still be standing here with maybe a TENS machine and my back brace. I'd be on full doses of my painkillers, and I'm not in any pain right now at all from lifting boxes and things. It's like a completely different, it's a new back.
Amen. Thank you. We give God glory, don't we? Thank you. So I believe God does heal today. And we're going to hear another testimony now.
Hi, everybody. Okay. For the most part of my life, I have felt like Robinson Crusoe, on my own little island, cut off and profoundly lonely. It is as if I've lived in an abandoned cave where all the previous occupants left in haste in the middle of a winter's night and forgot to take me with them. Did they leave because it was dark and damp, or was it something I said? Either way, the net effect is exactly the same. There's me, the cold walls, the same old view, and the sounds of silence. Name it. Depression is the ultimate chameleon. My story may not look like yours. Over many decades, my depression has assumed a three-dimensional character and has morphed into a she, who I now refer to as Deirdre. I have on occasions questioned the wisdom of attributing a name and personality to this dark figure, afraid that she might be pleased to have attained the status of a living lodger, or more accurately, squatter. I used to worry that she might think she deserves the same space and respect afforded the actual occupants of my home. And how can something which embodies isolation, numbness, and despair be a persona? For years, depression was an it, with no definable identity or form. It came like a cloud of freezing fog, enveloping and paralyzing me, sometimes for months on end. But by attributing a name to it, I began to see things more clearly. The it became a she, shriveled, hunched up caricature from a bygone era. Dirty nails, rolled up cigarette in her yellow fingers, loitering in the shadows. One day I realized that there was biblical precedent for renaming things, and this got me thinking. Abram became Abraham, Judah, Israel, Simon, Peter, and Saul became Paul. God renamed people like we press reset. That moment in time marked a fresh departure in a paradigm shift, the start of one relationship and the end of another. Also, by naming depression, I slowly began to gain authority over the illness. I named you, Deirdre, like God in Genesis naming his creation. So I get to define your role and position in my world. You, like the sun and the stars, can only occupy your allotted space and time. Response is everything. Gillian Duffy is a pensioner from Rochdale who back in 2010 is credited by many, myself included, with unwittingly toppling Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of the day, with her remarks about immigration. Prime Minister Brown forgot to switch off his microphone, and his ill-judged words in the taxi about her afterwards were broadcast for the entire nation to hear. My fascination with this most unlikely David versus Goliath style interaction is that it wasn't her criticism of government policy that brought him down, but Gordon Brown's response to her words. There was some truth in Gillian Duffy's point. If she'd accused the Prime Minister of extramarital indiscretions, she would have been dismissed. Deirdre doesn't tell me I'm an illiterate alcoholic because I have objective proof to the contrary. But she does say that person doesn't really like you. Or you haven't got imposter syndrome, you are an imposter. Or call yourself a Christian, and such things are less easy to deflect. Response and reaction are two different things. My stomach may flip over some critical remark, but my response is what will determine the kind of seating I offer Deirdre. Barstool? Deck chair? Sofa? The comfier she is, the longer she will stay. habits. Aristotle said, success is a habit. Aware of my own frailties and susceptibility to depression, I have, especially over recent years, developed habits which have helped keep my head above water when the world around me is collapsing. And by the way, these habits have nothing to do with a poem by Rudyard Kipling about keeping your head when everyone else is losing theirs. This is called Stoicism. And whilst there is some value in that philosophy, not every millennial is a snowflake, it can lead to self-reliance and a hardening of one's heart and mind, which isn't helpful in the long term. Reading a psalm every morning is one of my habits. Thanks to the wonders of modern technology, neuroscientists can now see in 3D colour from the MRI scans of people with mental illness that the auditory part of the brain, which hears voices, external or internal, can be silenced or cancelled out by listening to another competing voice or sound. Meditating on biblical verses changes my auditory focal point so that I'm listening out for God's signal instead of leaning into the noise coming from Deirdre's corner. Mm. Nature despises a vacuum, so I fill my head before someone else does it for me. The past has passed. Egged on by Deirdre, I have attributed the sad state of my mind to my less than perfect childhood. The middle of seven children, I was rarely aware of love, and I had to completely relearn the meaning of the word father when I became a Christian. It is tempting to blame your genes or your parents for everything, from your weight to your success or lack of it. There is some truth in this. Like I said, Deirdre doesn't spout complete nonsense. But if you think your family is dysfunctional, have a peep at David, who wrote Psalm 3 while he was fleeing for his life from his own son, Absalom, who had rallied 12,000 soldiers to attack his dad, quote, while he is weary and weak, end of quote. Nice boy. Not surprisingly, Psalm 3 reads, Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. Recognize that voice? Next verse. But you, Lord, are a shield around me. My glory, the one who lifts my head high. I call out to the Lord and he answers me. I believe I have wasted years of my life feeling sorry for myself, wishing I'd been brought up by Mr. and Mrs. Enid Blyton and gone to Mallory Towers for my education. For some reason, it felt good to go over these pointless regrets and pick the scabs until they bled again and again. It has literally taken decades to even begin to learn that the negative influences of past relationships can only influence my present-day thinking to the extent that I let them. 2019. We were discussing our children when Steve Dunford said to me, one time, it's the last time you ever pick up your child. But it's only in hindsight that you realise that truth. You size up your bouncing 9-year-old and think, yeah, well, pick yourself up off the floor now. In spring this year, something happened to me for the last time. I was planning to come to the usual Monday morning prayer meeting when I messaged Craig and said I wouldn't be there as I was too depressed to even attend. The group prayed for me with their usual passion, love, and sincerity. In his mind's eye, Craig saw a dark shadow recede from over my house and move away. I thought, how sweet and kind of everybody. But slowly, imperceptibly, and without drama, I felt different. I could use all kinds of metaphors, like a chrysalis becoming a butterfly or sunlight pouring through the cloud after a storm. But every day, I found within me a new sense of resilience, a transcendent peace, a bounce, a freedom like you have when you're skiing down a mountain or swimming underwater. Spring 2019 was the last time I offered Deirdre a seat. The last time I listened to her long list of why I was a worthless person pretending to be a Christian. And the last time I took her advice to stay home rather than attend a prayer meeting.
Thank you, Esther. Thank you, Sarah. There's nothing like hearing it from the proverbial horse's mouth, shall we say, of what it means when God touches a life. I've got lots of notes, but I will jettison most. I want to tell you a story. Back in the early 1990s, I went on several trips to Romania and Moldova. I've mentioned one trip previously where I met Stefan the leper. But I was taken into rural Romania in the 1990s, just came out of communism. It was like going back centuries in time, centuries in time, a very feudal type landscape. And I was a Westerner in rural Romania, so I was a first Westerner they'd seen in that sense. And I was invited to go and preach with a local pastor, and we were whisked onto a church that would be bigger than this with one 60-watt bulb for the entire lighting of the entire building. And I preached, and we were then, in a sense, whisked into a car to go on to a next destination, give some supplies and preach. And as we were leaving, a couple came up to us, myself and the Romanian pastor. She was obviously pregnant. And they came up in floods of tears, and through the interpreter of the pastor, they related their story. And this lady was 6 months pregnant, but within a few months of her pregnancy commencing, she detected a lump in her breast that was now growing rapidly and spreading. And though they're in rural Romania, they went to Bucharest, where you would basically call better services. And she was given an ultimatum by the medical profession. You terminate your baby and we will treat you. That's your choice. Or you run the risk of going full term, deliver the baby, and if you are treatable then, it hasn't gone too far, we will then commence treatment. They came running to me and they kind of sort of treated me like the Apostle Paul. What should we do? What should we do? There's your choice. End your baby and get treatment, or have your baby and if you're still alive, have treatment. I said, I can't advise you on that. I said, all I can do is pray. And we prayed. The pastor and I, we just prayed for them, and they just left, and we jumped in our cars and off to the next village to preach and give out more supplies. And 2 or 3 days later, I was flying back home to Bridgend, back into work, back into partly leading the church in Newcastle Hill, where we were located. And I have to think that for many weeks, that woman was on my mind, but I have to be honest, with the busyness of life, and doing church and doing work, she just gradually slipped out of my memories. And I forgot all about her. 3 years later, that Romanian pastor came to this country to preach. And we actually invited him, and he came and preached at our church when it was in another location. And I had even forgotten to ask him about this lady. He would never saw her again, we thought, anyway. And halfway through preaching, he said, he just turned to me as he was in full flow, and I was the convener. He just turned to me and said, Dave, remember that woman we prayed for in the village, the pregnant woman with the tumor and spreading cancer? I said, yeah. You know, he stopped preaching, and we were having a conversation. And he said, when they went home, they decided she will have the baby. She will put this in God's hands. The baby was born healthy. So they rushed her straight then. As soon as she could find a woman in the village who had milk, no baby milk, no none of this stuff. As soon as she could find a mum who had milk, she went off to Bucharest. They went to see the doctors. And the doctor said, your cancer is gone. Isn't that wonderful? But now I balance all this up, my friends. Because I have prayed for you. And some of you have not been healed. I look out now. I don't see James Langford. I don't see Mike Kernel. I don't see Gene Phillips. So where do we go with all of this? How did the Apostle Paul fare in all of this? The man who would take off a sweatband, give it to someone, and they would touch somebody with it and they would be healed. How did the Apostle Paul fare? Well, Paul would say to his closest friend, Timothy, drink some wine because you're always ill, Timothy. Why didn't Paul heal Timothy? Why does he write to the Philippian church and say, Epaphroditus, my close friend, nearly died for the sake of the gospel? We don't hear of a handkerchief being passed to Epaphroditus and he's healed. At the very last thing that Paul writes to the church, the second book of Timothy, he says, Alexander, he did me so much harm and everyone's deserted me. And I went to the trial, everyone deserted me. And he says, Trophimus, I left sick in my... This is where this all these thoughts come. Trophimus, I left sick in Miletus. Paul was on death row virtually, and he needed his friends and his companions around him. No doubt Paul had prayed for Timothy. No doubt Paul had prayed for Epaphroditus. No doubt Paul had prayed for Trophimus. But these men were not miraculously healed. And for those who decry this God, will point to those scriptures and say, Paul was peddling a false God and a false religion. There's the proof. And I have to say to you, some Christians, you prefer to airbrush those scriptures out because you say God will heal. But as I said in the start of this talk, there is something deep in the heart of God that I leave to the wisdom and the purposes of God. But I want to just touch on how did Paul deal with this? Paul, writing to the Galatian church, said, the only reason I actually preached to you was that I had an illness. A man of God who healed thousands maybe. But he said, I only preached to you because I had an illness. And if you could, you would have gouged your eyes out and given them to me. And then come into the book of Corinthians. He writes the second letter to the Corinthian church. And he says this in 12 verse 7. Therefore, in order to keep me from being conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses. And here is the key, my friends. Here is the key, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, in insults, in hardship, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. We know nothing about this thorn. Commentators from the earliest church fathers have said it was malaria, it was epilepsy, it was the problem with his eyes that he speaks to the Galatian church about. We don't know, but it was some form of physical ailment that the forces of the enemy then used to goad Paul to say, how can you be a man of God? How can you be a Christian when you are touching and healing people when your very eyes itself are in no good condition? That was the torment Paul lived under. But the way God deals with Paul opens the door to a far greater understanding of sickness than you and I can even begin to grasp. It is in God's intervention into our life. And it's in these words, so that the Christ's power may rest on me. In essence, God used this weakness of Paul, his physical weakness, to display his strength. and the power of God resting upon the life of an individual, of a Christian, whether he heals or not, is a powerful witness to onlookers that that individual can be different because Christ's power is resting upon them. I want to say this. The grace of God is stronger than any thorn in any side. And the grace of God is stronger than any tormentor who wants to pull you down and drag you into the muck and mire, the Deirdre's of this world. In 3 weeks' time, I'm preaching on spiritual warfare, friends. I'll be referring to some of that. In essence, Paul's prayer was answered, not by healing in this instance, but by the supernatural grace of God to bear it, so that Christ's power may rest in me, rest upon me. Christ's power may rest upon me. Now you need to pull that word apart, rest. What Paul is literally saying is this, so that Christ will pitch his tent over me and dwell with me in that tent. Remember, Paul was a tent maker. His apron and his sweatband. As he was doing this, he could sense, and then he was thinking this, that the power of Christ will, in my weakness, in my sickness, Christ's power will rest in me. He will pitch a tent over me, and he will dwell with me in that situation. And when Paul says that, oh, you may not be healed, but you're the promise of God to a believing son or daughter of God. God will pitch his tent over you and he will dwell with you. Paul preaching was so effective despite his physical weakness, thus displaying the God's work in his life, God's power. So that's why Paul says, I'm delighted in my weakness. I'm delighted when I'm insulted. I'm delighted in hardships. I'm delighted in persecutions. I'm delighted in difficulties. For when I am weak, I am spiritually strong in the Lord. He welcomed it for the sake of Christ. I believe that God does heal today, my friends, and we've seen some witness of it, and we've heard testimonies of that. But God's healing is not the only path he may choose to take in your life and mine. Sometimes his perfect plan for our lives is to take us through illnesses and hardships so that he may teach us and show us and build us up in other areas. When that happens, if and when God does not heal, and I'm still talking about natural health, natural healing, medical science, supernatural healing. When that does not happen, God has a better plan. Yes. Yes. He still loves, he still has a profound purpose for that pain or sickness that can end up being a blessing and a powerful testimony to all. For the Christian, no sickness is permanent. All sickness is temporary. All frailties, all infirmities, all cancer, all dementia, they're all momentary thorns in the flesh when compared to the eternal vibrancy of eternal life. But whilst we're in this tent of this body, whether God heals or not, he has promised to pitch his tent over you and dwell with you. God will heal sometimes. He will pour in his grace as we have heard this morning, but he will never forsake or abandon. He will pitch his tent over you whilst we live in this broken and hurting world. Please put up Isaiah 4, 5 and 6. I want to show you this, my friends. These scriptures that will come on the screen now, they have a strong second coming millennial feel to them, but they explain exactly what Paul was saying. Let me read them. Then the Lord will create over all of Zion and over those who assemble there a cloud of smoke by day, and a glowing flame of fire by night. Over everything, the glory of the Lord will be a canopy. Verse 6, it will be a shelter from the shade, shelter and shade from the heat of the day, and a refuge and hiding place from the storm and the rain. This is yet to happen. This is yet to happen in the eternal purposes of God. This is a second coming, millennial thought. I believe in the millennial coming, millennial reign of Christ. I hold to that teaching. This is to come. But this is what Isaiah is prophesying for the future of Israel. That over God's people, over this place, God's glory will be seen like a canopy. God's protection will be seen like a shelter. Now, verse 5, canopy, huppah. Huppah is, in Hebrew, what is where a marriage, in a marriage ceremony, where a husband and wife come together in marriage. The canopy is a wedding canopy. It's where husband and wife are joined together. Shelter is sukkah. Sukkah is where when the Israelites wandered through the wilderness and they dwelt in their booths in the wilderness for those 40 years with God leading them. This is what Paul is saying, my friends. For those, when Christ's power will rest on you, it's Christ's glory resting on you. It will be this, that in your sickness, as Paul is saying, the bridegroom will come and dwell with you. And he will walk with you through the wilderness all your days. And as David said, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So look at the life of the Apostle Paul. A man who could take a sweatband off his sweaty head and give it to someone, and they were healed. It's the same man who didn't see healing in his own friends and in his own life. But in his ministry and in his service to the Lord, he knew Christ's power resting on him. So though he remained physically weak, spiritually he was a giant in the service of the Lord. And that's God's promise to you today, Christian friend. I believe God heals. I believe God heals. And I'm going to leave it open. I'm going to hand over to my learned friend. I believe God heals in this place today. But I want to balance scripture. That if it's in God's heart that he will not heal you now today, he has promised his power will overshadow you. The bridegroom will be your partner in life, and his glory will rest upon you. And we as Christians can know the God's glory and power. In our weakness, we can know the strength of God. And we can walk through this life as a witness, as a testimony to this world around us, that we are walking in the purposes of God. Yes. And the day will come when our sickness is temporary. And we will be forever with the Lord, vibrant and healthy and whole. How is that possible? Because Christ took our greatest malady. Christ took our greatest sickness. He carried our griefs. He bore our griefs. And he carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. He was taken from prison and for judgment. And who shall declare his generation? He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before a shearer is silent, so he opened not his mouth. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid our faces from him. All we like sheep have gone astray, each has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Christian friend, you can only know healing because by his stripes we are healed. By his wounds we know health and wholeness, spiritual and I believe physical, whether it's an instantaneous healing a process of healing or God's power over your life to walk and be with you all your days. Do you know what body ministry is? We take a leaf out of Jesus' book and we bear with one another. We carry one another. We help one another. Because when we do that, you are displaying the very grace of God to others in your own life. That's a leaf out of Jesus' book. So we're going to come and share the test. Well, will those serving please come, and musicians come. The canopy, the power of God, the glory of God, the healing of God, the awesomeness of God. All that came because of the cross and his death, where our evil was lumped upon him, our sin. And I feel compelled to say this now. If you are listening to this message and you are strangely, strangely moved, then that is a good indication that the Holy Spirit is working in your life right now. And I invite anyone who doesn't know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, because all that I've said so far this morning relates to the Christian alone. Non-Christian, it's you and sickness. But listen to the stories we've heard this morning. Christian, it's you, God, and sickness. And he will never leave you nor forsake you. And so, Lord, as we take these emblems and we share them together now, let us remember that you were broken, you were wounded, you took our sicknesses and our sorrows upon yourself so that we can know wholeness and healing and health and salvation, the greatest gift of all, through your sacrifice. So may we eat worthily. May we partake worthily in Jesus' name.